Hey, everybody, you're listening to the Wait What If podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kevin Sullivan. I set up tonight on my back porch, and I realized it's still summer, and we have like some sort of 20-year cicada thing going on right now. Wait, hear him? Listen. So pretty much during the whole interview, we're going to be hearing that noise. It's not as loud as it was actually a few weeks ago. These things are crazy loud. Like, you can't sit on the back porch. It feels like, I don't know if you've ever had a migraine headache, but the noise they make makes you feel like you're having a migraine headache. I mean, it's like stereo, just awful, screeching, rattling, horrid noise. Yeah, so I figured what a good idea. Just set up 10 feet away from where these little bastards live and should have a good recording. Tonight we have a gentleman coming on named Carlos Pedraza. He is the creator of a website called AXA, A-X-A, Monitor, M-O-N-I-T-O-R. And what he does is he's following this case, a copyright case, maybe? I don't know. You'll hear all about it. So basically, this guy wrote his own version of Star Trek and put it on Kickstarter and got hundreds of thousands of dollars of backing for it. And technology has afforded people the ability to make some really, really high-tech stuff in like their basement. And he had some legit actors sign on to it. And Paramount and CBS heard this and they were like, no, can't do that. We have the Star Trek brand. And yeah, so they put a halt on it. And then, well, you'll hear all about it. So he's on and we're going to be talking about all sorts of stuff. So stay tuned.
You're listening to the Wait What If podcast.
We're about to blow stuff up.
Say we were to walk out in the middle of the woods and find a 50-year-old moonshine bottle.
I think you could drink it.
I think I would drink it.
You know, his mom was probably really controlling and he wet the bed as a kid.
Reminds me of a strip club, actually.
Does it really?
Yeah, this is the champagne.
Ladies and gentlemen, make sure you put the money in the middle.
I'm just going to eat this bacon and drink this whiskey.
Be prepared to expand your mind and question your reality. As always, your host, Kevin Sullivan.
And as always, our podcast is brought to you by Onnit. Onnit, I'm just checking my text right now. I'm making sure that Carlos is ready to come on. We'll see. We'll try him on FaceTime. I don't know if FaceTime's going to work as well, but we'll try. Let's take a look here. I don't know. So we are brought to you by Onnit. Onnit, waitwhatif.com/Onnit. If you are interested in health, fitness, in, I guess we could call it non-typical, like you're not your GNC variety stuff, then check it out. A lot of research goes into this, a lot of just really cool stuff. I'm really not giving any justice right now because I'm trying to put Carlos into the thing here. Hold on a minute. Let me do a couple things here. All right, now I can hear. Turn you up a little bit.
And okay.
So let's go over your bio real quick, and I just
sure.
put it up, and if you want, I can let you introduce yourself. That might actually be easier because I don't want to butcher anything.
Well,
from what I understand, is you're a what did you study up in college?
Well, for undergrad, I studied journalism and history, okay, as a matter of fact. and so, so right out of college, I went to work for the Associated Press, and then I worked for school as a teacher, a high school program, leadership program based at Seattle University.
Okay.
Then I went to another newspaper on the eastern side of Washington State. Then I went to work for the governor here, and then went to graduate school in Maine. And then I worked for the government in D.C., and then I moved back to the West Coast in 2000 to start a nonprofit. It kind of went belly up after a while, but I learned a lot and went to work for one of the contractors who used to work for me when I was working for the government. And so I was there for quite a long time. Moved back up to Seattle to work for the do some contract work for the Gates Foundation, and then decided to give filmmaking a full-time shot. So that was almost... that was about 9 years ago.
Okay.
So,
and you're creative by nature. You
yeah.
So, what type of journalism did you cover? Was it politics? Was it?
Well, when I was when I started out at the AP, you kind of have to do everything.
Okay.
Because it's whatever, you know, breaks on that day. People do tend to come up with specialties, and I did a lot of stuff around entertainment and some legal stuff around immigration.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I covered everything from, you know, murder trials to forest fires and, public hearings on environmental impact statements. And, you just had to be very flexible and learn a lot.
I can't remember the first time I heard about it, but I remember it might've been on another podcast or something. And they were talking about, technology and where technology is taking the creativity level or creativity in general. And one of the big things was you have these big production agencies, right? And you have big studios, Paramount, CBS, which we'll get into,
mm-hmm,
that have a lot of money, and they can pump money into films and make something really, really good, right? Or visually appealing. The way technology has it is there's people in their basements, that are beginning to have that technology available to them and the wherewithal to actually put together some really, really intense and really, really interesting CGI effects and stories, and they're putting it out there at a fraction of the cost. And that was the first thing that made me start looking into it. I said, wow, that's a really neat concept, a neat idea that people are basically doing something that there's no way they could do 20 years ago. And when I started researching that topic, I found, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right. I don't know if it's Axinar.
Yep.
Or is it Axinar?
It's Axinar.
Okay.
It's Axinar.
So I find this thing Axinar, and I find your website, Axinar Monitor, and actually I might have found you on Twitter first.
I think it was Twitter.
Okay.
I think it was Twitter.
And yeah, that's exactly right, because I saw it and I said, hey, this is coincidental, and I clicked on there, and it was all the things I had been finding there. And it basically is exactly, well, and maybe I'm wrong, and that's why you're on the show. it seems as though that's what happened. There was a fan that... we can go all the way back. Let's go all the way back to 1990 with Alec Peters.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the early stages and who Alec is.
Well, I mean, I don't know Alec Peters personally. So, mm-hmm, although, you know, it turns out we know a lot of people in common, because his foray into fan films began, I think, almost literally about the time that mine ended, which was around maybe like 2009 or so.
Okay.
That's when I decided to make my own feature film. And so I left at that point. I was working on my second fan production, Star Trek New Voyages, which is among the older ones and certainly one of the bigger ones in terms of production value. And so I'd been with them for several years, mm-hmm, and then decided to make my own feature film, and so I left, and I think Alec Peters joined New Voyages very shortly after I left. So I think we were sort of like two ships passing in the night.
Okay.
And so I think he caught the fan film bug from working on New Voyages, and he was encouraged by one of the people who who worked on New Voyages, who was a very good friend of mine, to pursue his idea about writing a screenplay about one of his favorite characters from Star Trek, the Captain Garth of Izar. So he was always interested in that character, and then Alec Peters is also a role game player. He does role playing games.
Yeah, right.
And so he discovered there was a Star Trek role playing game that I think started up in the 70s and went, I think, as late as the 90s by a company called FASA that, you know, was role playing for Star Trek. And they had developed a storyline, a source book for their game called The 4 Years War, which they theorized was the first war between the Federation and the Klingon Empire. Now, that's not official Star Trek history. Star Trek has this concept of canon, which basically says if it was on a TV screen or on a movie screen, it's canon, it's official.
Okay.
And if it's not those things, if it's a book, if it's blueprints, if it's role-playing game source books, those things don't count. And
But that's kind of silly because it's to who, you know, who does it not count to?
Well, of course,
right?
You know, yeah. I mean, it means basically that the people who create Star Trek for the copyright holders are not bound by something that was said or done in for example, a book, one of the novelizations of Star Trek, or Star Trek novels. So basically it's just to give them freedom, the studios and their writers freedom to do what they want and not have to be bound by what someone, you know, at a role-playing game company put together 20 years before.
Right. Okay.
So in 1990, Alec Peters wrote a story about Garth of Izar and the 4 Years War between the Federation and the Klingons. And, you know, it had been noodling around in his head for quite a while. So fast forward to 2010, he started working with Star Trek New Voyages.
And what's that? And what's New Voyages?
So New Voyages is of the big Star Trek fan productions, it is the oldest. It's not the oldest fan production, but it's close. The first fan film that I worked on was a series called Star Trek Hidden Frontier. It started in 2000 and went for 50 episodes, had two spinoffs, some audio drama spinoffs, but it never had, you know, it was done with a green screen in someone's spare bedroom and sometimes on location. So it was one of the earliest ones, and it's one that has a series. I mean, we put out, they started out doing 9 episodes a year. We cut back to 6 just to be able to improve some of the production values. And so that's how I ended up meeting James Cawley, who is the person who leads Star Trek New Voyages. So he, like Alec Peters, was always a big fan of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. James worked for alongside the head costumer for Star Trek: The Next Generation, and so he actually, you know, was in Los Angeles working on the new Next Generation set for quite some time. And so then he decided, you know, he's such a big fan, he decided to build his own bridge. And so it started off, I think, in his family's basement, or it moved several times from a basement to, you know, to an office building, to a former Ford car dealership, and now it's housed in a former dollar store in downtown Ticonderoga, New York. So each time it's gotten bigger and more elaborate, and James always just wanted to play Captain Kirk and to be able to have a real enterprise to do this on. And so he decided to make the first episode of Star Trek New Voyages. That was probably around 2004, 2005, I think.
Okay.
And, you know, because he had people, you know, he'd worked for official Star Trek at Paramount at the time, he had contacts. So, you know, he got actual costume designs. He knew writers, he knew actors, and he convinced them to come aboard and help out. And they did, and made a big splash. And they put out, you know, an average of one episode a year. They filmed in the summer, almost every summer, which I can tell you in Ticonderoga, New York, is very, very hot and humid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was. We did not have air conditioning in that studio, and so it was taxing. Now, but it was a lot of fun, you know. And people pitched in, and you know, for everything from CGI to costuming to acting, and you know, we were fortunate enough to have in those early episodes a lot of actors who've been in the original series and other of the Star Trek series appear at one point or another in an episode. So
now I have a quick question: is this this is all hobby level stuff, or where is this being screened? Now it's on YouTube. I'm flipping as you're talking. YouTube. I'm flipping through it.
Yeah, I mean, back when we started, before there was a YouTube,
yeah,
you had to do it on your own servers, and so that meant it cost you money,
sure,
for the bandwidth. And you know, and like with Hidden Frontier, you know, if you find those episodes, they were released in what would today be considered really small resolution, that didn't scale up. I mean, it was shot obviously in higher resolution, but one of the things we tried to be careful of was not to step over any lines with CBS and Paramount. So we kept things deliberately low resolution so that they'd never think, oh, you're trying to compete with us. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny to me that that's really sort of come around full circle, because of course that's one of the concerns that has come up with regard to this lawsuit that CBS and Paramount have brought against Axanar. So back then, you know, it was about getting volunteers to help mirror these episodes, the videos, mm-hmm, for these episodes, and then people would go in and download. I mean, some people were still on dial-up, for goodness sake.
Wow.
And they would wait literally hours for an episode, you know, like at 320p. I mean, it's just, wow, this tiny QuickTime window to download so they could watch it. And so there was a very devoted group of fans, tens of thousands of people who watched that show. And James Colley from New Voyages was a fan of the show as well. We ended up doing some collaborations between the two productions. So before YouTube and Vimeo and things like that, you know, doing a fan films was a lot of money that you put in. I mean, that bridge set that James built, that was built with his money. He's an Elvis impersonator in his real job, and you know, made enough money from that to be able to literally build the Enterprise. So, you know, so it took money out of people's pockets, for sure. And there were people who, you know, who worked on the production, who not only gave blood, sweat, and tears, but also gave money as well. So pretty much it was a self-financed operation, all of these fan films, up until the advent of crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm. Did a lot of the actors I assume you had stagehands and whatever, and grips and all the stuff that, because I know nothing about filmmaking, but mm-hmm, did a lot of them volunteer to get, you know, to pad their resume, to, you know, give them a portfolio, or
it's a lot. There are people, a lot of people were there for different reasons. So there were some people who wanted to learn filmmaking, mm-hmm, and I was among them. I mean, I refer to my time on Hidden Frontier and New Voyages as my film school.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I did that for several years. And so, yeah, I wanted to learn how to become a screenwriter, how to produce things, from concept through post-production. And so that was really the way that I learned it. So there were people like me who loved Star Trek, but also loved film and wanted to learn what it takes to make one. And then there were people who were full-on professionals, some of whom had worked for Paramount and specifically for Star Trek, others who'd worked on other TV productions or film productions who just really loved Star Trek. I mean, the love of Star Trek really was the thing that united everybody who was there.
Sure.
But they came from all walks of life. And so some of them were just people with absolutely no experience, but were willing to learn and willing to put in the sweat. And so they did. So they learned how to become grips, and they they learned how to light and they learned how to sew costumes and all of those things. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why a lot of these productions really are feel like families, because they've gone through a lot together. They've learned a lot together. They've suffered through a lot together. And that counts for a lot. And unfortunately, I think with Axanar, it started out wanting so much to be professional that I don't think that family thing ever truly happened across the board in the way that it does for other fan films. But, you know, on the other hand, what they were able to produce in their short film, Prelude to Axanar, mm-hmm. was, you know, it was something that was very professional looking, and it had a lot going for it. My new friend Christian Gossett directed that, and I think he did a phenomenal job, given how quickly they did it, where they start with, and how quickly they had to deliver it. So, you know, it's a 20-minute short, covers a lot of territory, and of course, its main aim was to raise money for the feature version,
sure.
Which of course is not been made and may never be made at this point, but right. that was the point of it. And it made a huge splash and did what it needed to do, which was go on to raise another, you know, $1.1 million, which is
wow.
amazing.
Yeah,
for
it really
a
is. For, and for crowdfunding. I just really want to, I've been flipping through the, just kind of fast forwarding through some of this, the New Voyages, and, I mean, it rivals, you know, the 1980s and 1990s Star Treks. I mean, as far as technology, the look. I mean, I think it's funny that Spock looks like Zachary Quinto. I think that was a good.
You know, there's a funny thing that actor who I cast that actor originally for Hidden Frontier, Brandon yeah. Stacey. So I've known Brandon for a long time, and. We had him play a villain on Hidden Frontier, a telepathic villain. Uh-huh. And then when James was looking for a new Spock, he said, you know, that guy that you had on that on those couple of episodes, can you give me his contact information? I said, sure. So so I did. And then Brandon, you know, came in and he was their third Spock, and he stuck by them for quite a while since coming aboard. And but interesting side note about that actor, Brandon Stacey, is that he actually – I believe was a stand-in for Zachary Quinto.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It makes. I mean, when I first saw it, I said, "Wait a minute, am I on the right one here?" Yeah, he looks just like him. But no, I mean the production, even like the wide-angle shots of the Enterprise flying through. I mean, that's all some pretty cool stuff. I don't know. I'm pretty impressed with that.
Yeah, I mean the visual effects. Were in every case made by professionals who mm-hmm. who volunteered their services or gave some services at a very, very reduced cost. Again, united because they love Star Trek. I mean, all of these people want to be on the Enterprise. They want to create the actual starship and animate it through CGI. They want to fire phasers and photon torpedoes. These are very powerful parts of our culture now in the last 50 years, and people identify with it. A lot of people do, and the opportunity to be able to make it and have it approach anything like the quality of the original is a very, very tempting thing to be offered.
Sure. Now to kind of jump ahead here a little bit, so Alec Peters decided, did I get his name right? Just want to look here. Yeah. So they were going to, he wanted to do his full feature fan film. Mm-hmm. And they made The Prelude to Axanar, which is he released it on YouTube and Vimeo. Like, you can pretty much find it anywhere, right? If you were interested in looking.
Yeah, I mean, YouTube is its primary home, but, you know, people copy it different places onto other platforms and stuff. But YouTube's the easiest to get to and has the best bandwidth, so you don't have to worry too much about buffering and that sort of thing. So I think YouTube has really become the home of fan films in terms right. of distribution.
And when I was watching it, it's almost like a reality type of, right? Because they're interviewing these
yeah,
members.
Yeah, I mean, think of it as the History Channel of the future.
That's right, yeah.
So it's made very much like one of those History Channel retrospectives on things like, you know, World War II or something where they interview the veterans, you know, years later, reflecting back and then have some either a mix of actual footage or dramatized footage to illustrate the points. And I thought it was a brilliant way to tell that story and to tease the larger story they wanted to tell in the feature of Axanar. And, you know, there's some people now who, because of the bad blood around Alec Peters and this production, try to, you know, cast aspersions onto Axanar, but I never have, and I don't. I think it was a real achievement. I think people who watch it are kind of blown away the first time. They may change their mind later, but I think it stands alone in terms of what it has accomplished. And you know, unfortunately, I just don't think it was able to go on to fulfill that promise. But I know that the people who made Prelude to Axanar happen, again, many of them were professionals.
Yeah.
You know, they've done this before. They pulled it off big time. But the thing is, you know, about fan films is, it's as a business model, they're not sustainable. I mean, even with crowdfunding. So it depend. They depend so much on volunteers, blood, sweat, and tears, and sometimes a lot of tears. That as a business model, it's just, there's no way to sustain that. So once you move it into a thing where it has to make money, earn revenue, then it's not a fan film anymore. And that's sort of where we are in this weird place where this one film tried to sort of move beyond fan films and for a long time disdained that description of its project. As a fan film, they referred to themselves, and I quote this, as a fully professional, independent Star Trek production, and we're fully intending to pull that off. Unfortunately, I know that the folks at CBS and Paramount, to some extent as well, those words strung together in that fashion, yeah, set off some alarm bells for them.
So did he have an... To kind of explain then, so they started to, well, they put out the Prelude, mm-hmm, and then he used that as kind of the Kickstarter.
Yeah, I mean, it was literally like one after the other. So they shot Prelude in May of 2014, mm-hmm, over several days in May, and then had it ready just a couple months later to premiere at Comic-Con in July of 2014.
Insane. So 2 months, like I'm looking at it right now, and mm-hmm, yeah, 10 years ago, this would have been studio level production value. I mean, it's really good. I mean, there's Tony Dodd. You guys even had, or they even had, and if anyone doesn't know who Tony Dodd is, he was Candyman, one of the good B horror movies of the 80s, or maybe it was.
Yeah, he has a long and storied career, particularly in horror.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's played several different characters in Star Trek as well.
Oh, so. He has. Okay.
Oh yeah, yeah. One of the big Klingons in Deep Space Nine, and I think he was Worf's brother, in Deep Space Nine.
So it's really, really, like, if you take the new Voyages as a very decently made Star Trek, almost like a TV level sort of technology, now you look at Prelude to Axanar, this absolutely would be something that would rival the, I mean, I'm looking at a spaceship flying past a futuristic city, and it looks no different to me. Actually, it looks better than when... what was it when they made the new Star Wars films back in, what was it, 99? I don't remember when the new ones came out, but it was in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, late 90s, early 2000s.
I think it rivals if not better. And
yeah, well, you know, we're almost 20 years later, yeah. So that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, it is definitely a work of quality. I think they did a fantastic job. They assembled a fantastic team,
sure,
to pull that together and doing it so quickly. Because I can tell you that most fan films, their post-production is like hell, you know, like,
yeah.
on new Voyages, they would shoot their productions in the summer, but you wouldn't see it again for like release for a year to a year and a half later. by the time it went through editing and then all of the other post-production stuff, sound and colorization and all of that. And it just, it took a long time because, again, most of this was people doing it either for very low cost or as volunteers. And so it would just take a long time. And Axanar decided that they were going to do what it took to make sure that it got done quickly. Yeah. And so that involved paying people.
And it doesn't look like that at all. I mean, there's these panning shots, the interviews with the different characters. It's a very professional looking film. And that was probably there's Alec Peters. It's a downfall probably of the project itself. And I guess we'll get into that next because...
Yeah, I mean, that's what some people say. I actually... I don't believe that. What I think it did was open the door to the downfall. And we'll get into that, I'm sure, in a bit. But I don't think the quality of Prelude inherently meant that fan films were doomed. I think there were other issues at play ultimately that became issues only because it was so good.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that.
You don't think that, like, to me, a fan film or even New Voyages would be, Star Trek or CBS or Paramount would look at that and say, almost be honored by it, you know, because it's drawing in new viewers, new fans, and everyone wants to see J.J. Abrams direct it. You know, everyone wants to see go into the theater, see that massive screen and see whatever you call it, the effects that we pay for. You don't think that when they saw this and they said, hey, do you know what? we might be, you know, we can turn it, turn a blind eye to the the low budget or, you know, the stuff that's filmed inside of a empty dollar store. But now we're looking at, you know, something that really could rival. I mean, I don't know. It just seems to make sense that would be what happened, but you obviously know more about this.
I think a lot of people, I think that is the conventional wisdom, but based on what I know about, you know, I have contacts at CBS and in fan films, I don't think that the conventional wisdom is right here.
Okay.
I know it looks that way. I know it looks like, oh my God, this is on another level and this must have threatened CBS and Paramount. Because, you know, we know that they were the Star Trek feature films were rebooted by J.J. Abrams and to, pretty good success in terms of a box office, but to a lot of disappointment to especially older fans who felt like it was becoming too Star Wars-like and not Star Trek-like enough. And, so there's those sort of underlying tensions within the fandom that were at play as well. So then you see something like Prelude to Axanar that is so devoted to the same kind of look and themes as the original Star Trek that they're like, yes, this is what we always wanted. And, you know, and clearly CBS is threatened by it because it's so good. And it's like, you know, there'd been good fan films before, maybe not exactly at this level, but there'd been no real worry, I think, at the network about fan films as long as they stayed behind a certain line.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think Axanar crossed that line. That line was not about quality. That line was about making money.
Okay. So the motivation then for Axanar became money. I didn't realize because they obviously drew donations through Kickstarter, but it wasn't for profit. Were they looking to profit?
They will tell you no, and I think in the way that they define profit, that is true.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did was they set up a pretty sophisticated operation, an actual thing they called their donor store, an e-commerce site that people, it had, you know, products. It has an online catalog you go through, and it has everything from books to Starship models to patches and posters and artwork and coffee at one point. I mean, It was a full line of merchandise, and it is still operating to this day. I mean, it's still there, and they're fulfilling orders. And no fan film had ever done that before. You know, there had been some fan films, once crowdfunding happened, there had been some fan films that would make limited edition DVDs as perks or rewards for the Kickstarter campaign, Kickstarter donors or Indiegogo donors. So there'd been a little bit of that had happened, but nothing on this level.
Yeah.
You know, nothing of the kind of breadth of products that were being sold or continuing to be sold for what they call a donation. But it's really money's changing hands and products are being shipped. And I'm not sure at that point and at this extent that we're really talking about donations anymore. We're talking about an ongoing retail revenue stream, and that they refuse to account for. They've been asked repeatedly, how much money did you bring in from this operation? And they said 4 months ago in an interview that I did with their chief spokesman, Mike Bawden, he said, you know, we're going to let people know. We're having an accountant go through and total everything up, and we're going to let our donors know where we stand financially. Well, that's been 4 months now,
yeah.
almost five. And I don't know of an audit that takes that long. So we're still waiting to hear. And, you know, I have it on pretty good authority that they made money on top of the donations from the crowdfunding campaigns, you know, into the six figures.
And I guess that makes sense. I mean, I can't go and start printing, Star Wars paraphernalia or something like that and, you know, take donations and sell it. I mean, I don't know. To me, that's a no-brainer. You're almost asking for...
That's, you know, in the interview that John Van Sitters, who's this the vice president for consumer development, I'm blanking on his full title, but he's a vice president at CBS, who does things regarding licensing and product development. And he did this interview after the new fan film guidelines came out, in which he said, you know, for a long time, we just said let people have fun, just don't make money. That was the rule. Have fun, don't make money.
Sure.
And I think what happened was that Axanar, Alec Peters parsed that don't make money and turned it into don't make the profit. And, you know, anyone who knows about Hollywood accounting knows that you can rejigger your books so that a film that made literally billions of dollars can still show up as not having made its money back. I think one of the Star Wars films officially has not made its money back, even though it's made billions of dollars. So, you know, so there are ways you can divert money or call them expenses and so forth that, you know, none of this is illegal, mm-hmm. but it's so that you can stand up with a straight face or, you know, swear in a court, we did not make a profit. And I think that if this case goes to trial, you know, Alec Peters can raise his right hand and put his other hand on the Bible and say, I did not make a profit on this. But the thing is, for copyright infringement, you don't have to prove that a profit was made. You only have to prove that infringement happened. And as a part of that, if you received a direct financial benefit, those are the exact words that are used in copyright law. And they're the exact words that are used in the legal complaint that CBS and Paramount brought against Alec Peters and Axanar Productions, that describe the role of money in their endeavor. And yes, we definitely see, I mean, he paid himself a salary of $38,000 a year. He had the production pay for his dues for SAG-AFTRA because he joined the Actors Union, given that he played Garth in Prelude. And you know, so that's $41,000 right there. He traveled to conventions for 2 years, continuing to raise money and get support for Axanar and selling merchandise along the way, calling it donations. And so all of this was going on. In the meantime, the film wasn't getting produced. In some ways, they were kind of a victim of their own success, because there's this point. I've done an analysis of their crowdfunding campaigns. There are three campaigns where you look at graphs of the money that they were bringing in, where the campaigns start out where they set out these goals, they met these goals, they set new stretch goals, they met those goals. And, you know, so you see their goals and their fundraising pretty much matching each other on this graph. And then all of a sudden there's this critical mass that they reach when they realize we're at a point that we can set our goals really, really high. So let's do it.
Wow.
And so they did. And so then you see these goals continue to skyrocket, and the money that's coming in is going up for sure, but not as fast. And so they just realized, and again, if you read the frequently asked questions on the Axonar website, it tells you this explicitly. It's like they say, we realized that we were bringing in enough funding to make this much bigger than we originally thought it was going to be. And that's a good thing, because that's what our fans want to see. That's what Star Trek fans want to see. And so far, so good. I don't have a problem myself with any of that.
Right.
As long as they've taken those funds and put them towards producing the film.
Right.
But in their second Kickstarter campaign, they decided to do something else. And I, you know, earlier I said that we were talking about priorities and how you set priorities. And what happened was they decided to tell their fans, to tell people who are looking at donating to the feature film Axonar, you know what, we need our own studio to do this right. We need our own studio. We don't want to rent one. Which, you know, I'm an independent film producer and I would have rented one. And, you know, there's a whole, my friend and colleague, Jody Wheeler, did an analysis for, 1701news.com, which is a Star Trek, news website, mm-hmm. In which he, you know, cause Jody also is an independent film producer, and he actually costed out what it would have cost to rent, the facilities they need to produce Axonar versus building their own. And it would have been much less, like hundreds of thousands less. And that's money that could have been actually put into the film. But here's what happened. The tricky thing about that studio is that they signed a lease for 3 years on this studio. Well, it wasn't going to take 3 years to make this film. So they had other plans for that studio. And this isn't hearsay. If you read Axonar's annual report, and I go through and I meticulously analyze that on Axomonitor, you can just go there and put annual report in the search box, and there's a whole article that goes through paragraph by paragraph of that annual report. You know, they actually say up front, this studio will be used to make the best Axonar we can make, but we also want to make other fan films, and we also want to make our own original productions and rent it out for other productions to come in and use the studio space. And, you know, that's when it crossed the line from a fan film into a business venture.
It's a production company. I mean, what's the difference? What's the difference between, I mean, something as big as Paramount doing that exact same thing? I mean,
you know, makes sense. And there's nothing wrong with them wanting to do that. The difference, of course, is that they did it with the money that they raised using the Star Trek name.
Yeah.
Using the Star Trek brand. And that is what concerned CBS and Paramount. Almost exactly a year ago, August of 2015, CBS put out a statement in which it said that it had communicated its concerns to Alec Peters. And they said, we continue to object to professional commercial ventures. To commercial ventures trading off our property.
Sure, and honestly, that makes sense. I mean, coming at it from a person on the outside looking in, I can see the rift between Star Trek purists and folks that want to, you know, I guess, go with the higher quality CGI or whatever it is. I could see people who are defending the fan film genre, and it kind of makes sense to me that CBS and at first when I first read about this, I was kind of mad at CBS and Paramount, because I was thinking, you know, why would they stifle this? This is a creative venture that really, I mean, when it comes down to it, are they really pulling money away from the you know, the blockbusters that have been coming out at summertime for these Star Trek films? But yeah, you can't take, I can't go and take something that you did in one of your films and start marketing and
right.
Yeah, and making money off it. I mean, you just can't do it. It's intellectual property.
Yeah, it is. And you know that they've invested, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Sure.
And they've made, you know, billions from it. So, you know, it's a valuable property, and that's all the more reason why they need to protect it.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the narrative around Axanar, and they've done, I have to say they've done a really good job of this, is they keep portraying this lawsuit as an action taken against fans, the fans who love Star Trek the most.
Sure, and that's what I thought of it as.
Yeah, and you know, because the reality is that Alec Peters is a huge Star Trek fan. You know, there's an entire portion of the answer to the legal complaint that was submitted by his top-notch intellectual property lawyers at Winston & Strawn that spends an entire section of that legal filing, that legal document, talking about how much Alec Peters loved Star Trek from the time he was, you know, 6 years old.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, there was a podcast that that set it to music and called it The Ballad of Alec Peters. You know, it's heartfelt, and I believe in the sincerity of his love of Star Trek, and Rob Burnett, who is the director of Axanar, or hopes to be the director of Axanar if it's ever made, is also a huge Star Trek fan. He's very well known in the fan community, you know, for a lot of genre expertise. He's very well respected for that. Mm-hmm. So I don't doubt that sincerity, that they really, you know, so when they put that narrative out into the world, that much of it is true as far as it goes. They downplay the business end of it a lot. You know, I mean, there was one argument that I had with Rob Burnett over Twitter for hours over Twitter, in which he claimed that the studio was not a studio, that it was not that it was a warehouse in which they'd created a soundstage. And I'm like, that kind of sounds like a studio to me. Like, yeah. How is that not a studio? So, you know, and he still will say that. If you ask him directly, he will still say it's not the kind of studio you're trying to make it out to be. And it's like, a reasonable person would look at what you're doing and compare it to, you know, a soundstage at CBS or Paramount and go, yeah, you're trying to do the same thing, you know? Yeah. I mean, they put out a business plan in their annual report that literally talks about wanting to move down the line at actual commercial productions coming out of this facility that was built with donor funds raised off the Star Trek name. And that was the plan. They wanted to set up a science fiction streaming streaming service with things that were made by fans as kind of their niche in the industry. You know, they were planning on setting that up and charging people monthly subscription fees, and that's no longer a fan production. That's a business.
Yeah, it's a business.
But you don't hear that from them anymore. Like, they shut up about that. But unfortunately for them, it's there in black and white in their own annual report. It's in their podcast. Like, they're great at marketing Axanar. I do not fault them for that. They produced their podcasts on a regular basis and kept their fans in touch with what was going on and what kind of progress was made. They did all that very well. But they also, those podcasts may be some of the most damning evidence in this lawsuit, because they talk very forthrightly and very openly about their long-term plans for this studio and making money from it.
So what do you think? Do you think they have a chance at winning, or is this kind of an open shut case? Because they motioned to dismiss, right, when it first came out.
Yeah, they had two motions to dismiss. The first one was declared moot because CBS and Paramount amended their original complaint that took care of the major problems that the first motion to dismiss identified. And then right after they filed the amended legal complaint, Axanar's lawyers filed a second motion to dismiss, and this one went a little bit more into the legal theory that they were going to come around to actually using in court if it gets that far, and that one was pretty much blown out of the water by Judge Gary Klausner, who's the judge overseeing this case. Now, of course, it's not a ruling on the merits of the case, but it is him saying that the reasons that you're giving for why this should be dismissed aren't really reasons. And in fact, in a lot of ways, it was a real smackdown of this law firm that's a very well-respected law firm, international law firm, because they, he literally said to them, the cases that you're citing to back up your reasons for why this case should be dismissed don't really say what you say they say. And for a judge to tell a lawyer that's like the equivalent of being spanked in public.
Sure. And, I mean, that's their bread and butter.
And that happened,
Wow.
I mean, he even says in the thing on the whole talk around direct financial benefit versus profit, he said profit doesn't play any role in this. He cited cases that showed that if you're infringing, you don't have to make a profit for you to still be infringing. If you're trying to point people to a service that you're trying to sell or interest them or anything like that, that's enough.
Yeah.
And that's certainly what was happening here, I believe. And that's why, they're going to go in. There are a lot of people who think it's an open and shut case. And I'm actually not among them. I think that, however, that the defense has a lot to prove here. If you look at their answer to the legal complaint, they make an argument around fair use and copyright, and claiming that Axanar is sufficiently transformative. In other words, that it takes the source material, Star Trek, and does enough things to it to make it unique and its own unique creative product. And for that purpose, it should therefore qualify for fair use and not be bound by copyright infringement rules. So that's the defense they're putting together on that. But they have a very steep hill to climb because there's very little case law to support that point of view. Now, there are a lot of legal theorists. Well, I shouldn't say a lot. There are some significant legal theorists who say that fan work, fan fiction, fan art, fan films do deserve a kind of protection under fair use. And I myself believe that even to a certain extent, and a court can find that to be the case. But that doesn't change what happened with Axanar, which is once they cross the line into becoming a commercial venture, they're not really fans anymore. And yeah. So that's what I think is going to make it a much harder case for them to prove, because they're going to have to show that this is not the kind of fan work that qualifies under even a very liberal interpretation of being transformative with the original copyrighted material. So it will be a very interesting case, and I think that's one of the reasons that Axanar got the law firm that they got, Winston & Strawn, because if they can do anything that sheds more light onto copyright law, that sheds more light defining more clearly what transformativeness means and what fair use means, that will be a win for them. They could lose the case,
sure,
but if they expanded those definitions or clarified the current definitions, because so much of copyright law is just based on court decisions rather than laws as they've been written by Congress. Trademark laws is the reverse. They have a lot of very specific legal provisions that are part of legislation, but copyright is much, much more left up to the interpretation of the courts. And because of the way our court systems work, sometimes you have, in the Ninth Circuit, one decision about copyright, and a very similar case in the Fourth Circuit finds it an entirely different finding, and it has to go to the Supreme Court then to iron that out, and that can take years in the best case scenario. And but what usually ends up happening is that the cases get settled out of court, and so then you have so the case is settled, but you have no better definition of what you know of what fair use means. So so that's why we are where we are, and I think why Winston and Strawn is so interested in this case, because it does present an opportunity to map out what is in many ways terra incognita in, as far as copyright law is concerned.
Sure, I mean they could set precedents. It could be a landmark case if they come up with something. Yeah.
If it goes to court, it has the potential to be a landmark case. You know, win or lose. Yeah. Frankly.
I was just going to say, to CBS. I guess from what I read, they're trying to meet Axanar halfway with a list of, you know, this should be what a fan film, or they try to define a fan film. What did you think about their list of quote unquote demands?
Well, if I were a fan producer, and one of the things I did on Axe Monitors, we went out and we actually contacted every Star Trek fan film that we could find. In fact, some that I had no idea even existed. And there are probably even more than the ones that we found. It's like 20-something of them.
Wow.
And we asked them, "What, you know, how are these guidelines going to affect you? What's going to happen? Are you going to continue?" You know, because before there were no rules. You could make hour-long, two-hour-long Star Trek films. You could use all kinds of, you know, people did use all kinds of intellectual property in these films. And but of course, you were always doing that with some measure of legal danger because you didn't have permission. We did not have permission to do any of the fan films that I worked on, which meant that if CBS wanted to, they could turn around and shut you down or threaten to sue you, mm-hmm. or both. But you know, for a major studio to have for decades basically said, have fun, don't make any money, and that was good enough. That was a big deal. And so to go against that very simple rule alerted CBS and Paramount. And they were very concerned. And so that's why, you know, people who say that this is about money, it's not about money. You know, $1.1 million that Axanar has raised. And ultimately, if they'd been successful in their ultimate budget for this film, they would have needed to raise just shy of $2 million. So interestingly, even if they win this lawsuit, they still have at least around $800,000 they need to raise before they can produce the film that they've promised their donors. So, so even if they win, they may not be able to raise the money to finish it, which means that they'll have to do something less than they wanted, and you know, nobody will end up being happy in that scenario.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly, gosh, I mean, that's an amazing story, and it's still ongoing, and I guess we're not going to know for a while what the outcome's going to be. It doesn't seem like it's, I mean, unless Axanar finally says, okay, you know, because I assume that who's paying for the legal fees? Like, I assume that those
Winston
guys
Winston and Strawn are doing it pro bono.
Okay, yeah, and that's what I assumed.
So that's their lawyer's time is pro bono, but that doesn't cover legal costs. So filing costs, you know, copying costs, you know, they're in the middle of discovery right now. So costs associated with, you know, flying in witnesses or flying out to interview witnesses for depositions, all of those are additional costs that are not covered under the pro bono agreement, more than likely, which means that those are expenses that Axanar is going to have to pay at some point.
At what point do you just say, okay, enough's enough?
Well, there's a number of things that can still happen short of a trial.
Mm-hmm.
One is that they could settle. And they have been, they've had ongoing settlement talks since at least March that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
And officially since May when CBS and Paramount put out a statement to that effect. So settlement would be the quickest way to, and least expensive way to bring this to resolution. Unfortunately, according to something Alec Peters said a couple of weeks ago, they have made no progress towards the settlement, or not enough progress. You know, it sounds like CBS and Paramount are sticking to their guns in terms of what they're willing to allow and not allow from this fan film, and it's not something that that Axanar believes they can live with. So they're in the middle of discovery, and I think what we'll see next, if a settlement doesn't happen, is that one or both sides are going to file a motion for summary judgment, in which they're going to go to the judge with the evidence they've gathered so far, mm-hmm. and the law as they interpret it, or hope that he interprets it as well, and say, between these two things, what we know is in the law and this evidence that we found, we believe there's enough evidence for you to make a decision in this case. Mm-hmm. And if he does, then that's a decision in the case. And it becomes a precedent. But of course, at that point, if it's something that Axanar isn't happy with, they can appeal that. So even if they lose the summary judgment, they can continue to appeal for as long as they have the gumption and resources to do so, till it gets the kind of review that it needs. So, you know, if it were to go from this point from federal district court in California, it would go to the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit could say, well, we don't think that there is enough evidence, so we're going to send it back to the district level, and you have to do a trial with a jury, and then come back to us, and we'll see what happens. So that could happen, or they could just dismiss it completely and just say, no, we disagree. Mm-hmm. Or we agree, they can affirm it, in which case they can ask that it goes to the Supreme Court. So that could be a process that could be, you know, 2 years, 3 years to really play out.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, they're still trying to pay rent and utilities and salaries, apparently, for Axanar, and not being able to make Axanar.
Wow.
So that means, you know, how long they can go with this. Obviously, they're going to try to rent out the facility to be able to meet their expenses and everything. But that only ends up, you know, proving the point that they're running a professional studio, you know, a revenue generating operation. So while they're able to maybe keep the studio, they're doing their own case some damage, because it's kind of proving what the plaintiffs are alleging.
And you got to give it to Alec Peters too. I mean, it takes some balls to go up against a big studio like that. I mean, they have,
it does indeed.
Yeah. They have endless resources. There's endless resources. I mean, where are they going to, they're not going to tap. they're waiting for an answer, and it's going to be how long that I guess he can hold out.
Yeah. I mean, it really depends. Yes, they have definite, much deeper pockets than Axanar does. But at the same time, and I think if you look at the media strategy that they've been using, they're doing is trying to get as much of this tried in the court of public opinion as they can, because I think that the pressure they're trying to bring to bear on the studios is public pressure, that so that it becomes untenable for the studios to continue to with the case, because they'll end up hurting themselves more than they will Axanar Productions. That's a risky strategy, but it is a good one, given the resources that they do have available. I'm just not sure that they're successful enough at making that case to the public. They've made a lot of progress. I mean, they have people believing that this case was dropped back in May when J.J. Abrams made that announcement. And there are people, I mean, someone asked me on Twitter just yesterday, I thought they dropped this lawsuit. I'm like, no, the lawsuit is very much alive, because, you know, one business day after J.J. Abrams said this lawsuit is going away, Axanar turned around and countersued them.
Oh,
so
wow.
Once they countersued, they can't drop it, because now they have to defend you know, it turns the tables. Now the plaintiffs are defendants, and so they have to defend themselves. And it sets a whole new time clock ticking, running concurrently with the original legal complaint. And while, yes, the first thing that the Axnar folks will tell you is that, you know, we were under a deadline to have to respond to that legal complaint, and that deadline was that week. So we were forced to have to counterclaim. And I think that's true as far as it goes. But I think realistically, if they were given this huge, huge gift by J.J. Abrams, mm-hmm. by opening the door to the possibility of a settlement, and what they could have done was have gone to the judge in this case. And he's a pretty hard-as-nails judge. He does not like tactics that delay things. He likes things resolved quickly and neatly. If they can be resolved short of trial, he's all for that. He does not want the court's time wasted.
Yeah.
That's the kind of judge that he is. If they had gone, both sides, to that judge on Monday morning after J.J. Abrams had made that announcement on Friday and said, look, can we have another week before we have to submit our answer to the legal complaint? Because we may be the closest we're going to get to a settlement today. Mm-hmm. So can we have a week? They didn't do that. They made a choice to not do that. And instead stick with what they thought was their schedule, go ahead and counterclaim. And unfortunately, that ended up just furthering the lawsuit. And here we are 2 months later, and it's still very much alive and in the thick of it.
So you obviously are probably the most knowledgeable on this whole story that's unraveling. Any desire to do a documentary on it or write a book or anything like that?
Well, you know, I have had actually a number of people ask me that, and the way I'm looking at it is, you know, for me, I left journalism a while ago. And for me, you know, my own film, I'm working on my third feature film right now. It's in post-production. Mm-hmm. And we were sort of in a down period during the time that this lawsuit happened. And so I had some time on my hands, and I care about this issue. And so so I started covering it the way I would as a reporter for the Associated Press. So that's what I'm focused on right now. I'm trying to finish my own feature film. We're now deep in the throes of post-production, mm-hmm. as we speak. So my time is not as free as it was back at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
So right now I'm just focusing on staying on top of this story and exploring the ins and outs of it. You know, if it goes to trial, it'll be a big deal. I will probably try to find a way to cover that trial. It's expected to be between 10 and 15 days in length, and is scheduled to begin on, I think, January 31st. So I'm gonna, you know, one of the reasons I started AxiMonitor was as a place to document all of this, so yeah. that all of this information would be in one place, it would be memorialized, and if a book or a documentary or something like that happens to be in the cards later, mm-hmm. great. The research has been done.
Yeah, that's
and we can move forward in that direction. But my own hope is that my film career continues to grow at a pace that I can make more movies. So, you know, I'm not really in this game to have it be some sort of career move for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, anyone who reads the internet knows that journalism is not a money-making venture these days. So
unless you do something outrageous to that can bury you.
Yeah, and I'm not. I mean, yeah. I'm covering this very conservatively, the way I would have for a wire service or a newspaper. So there's nothing glamorous in this. You know, fortunately, I've had a lot of people kind of come aboard to help me with some of the legwork that's required for this story. Mm-hmm. I've been able to develop sources, amongst all of the major players in this, and I get pretty good information on stuff, and then I try to disseminate that, because I really feel like the openness and transparency of this is super important. And it's something that, you know, Alec Peters claimed in his annual report was important to him and the people at Axnar, openness and transparency. And really the foremost reason why I started Ax Monitor was to hold them accountable to that. And unfortunately, we're not really seeing that.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's a fascinating story. And someone like myself, who's not, I mean, I grew up with my dad watching Star Trek, but I never got into it. I'm probably a Star Trek fan's worst, not worst anybody, you know what I mean? I'm the one that goes to the J.J. Abrams films and I get absorbed for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then I leave, and then that's all I have. But it's a fascinating story, and you don't have to be a fan of Star Trek. I mean, to you know, find yourself absorbed in this. Again, it's AXA Monitor. We have Carlos Pedreza, and to go over some of your films, I have to say that I watched the trailer for Judas Kiss, and I just mm-hmm. noticed that it's going to be on, or it is on Amazon Prime, so I'm going to check it out. I have to say, I like your twisted way of thinking there. So am I right?
Twisted.
When I watched this, so I watched the trailer, and it starts off, if I remember, he's like a struggling writer or whatever, and he goes to a school to teach, and he has a one night stand, and then there's some science fiction in there, a little bit of a plot twist. I don't want to give away too much, but I mean, I got it from the trailer, but the guy ends up hooking up with himself. Am I correct in this?
Yes. Okay. It's a little twisted.
I don't know where does that, that's not incest, right? Cause it's,
I think it's more like masturbation, but
I guess so. Yeah.
Which I think is a little more, people can wrap their heads around that a little bit more than the other.
That's hysterical.
It's, you know, and the young actor who plays in that, actually you'll see every week, he's one of the leads on the 100 on the CW network. His name is Richard Harmon.
Okay.
And so that's the same guy. He's a fantastic actor to work with, and obviously he's gone to some great places after he worked on our film. So
That's really good. So you can check out Judas Kiss on
it's on Amazon Prime, and I think it's on Netflix and Hulu as well. So,
oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. So if and iTunes, of course, is always on iTunes.
Okay, yeah. So folks are interested in checking out some of Carlos's work, and then of course you have you can go on YouTube and find The Hidden Frontiers, right? And the New Voyages, and then other things and the one you're working on now, is that Something Like Summer?
Yep, Something Like Summer.
Okay. And I always encourage everyone to check out the crowdsourcing.
Crowdfunding has played a huge role in enabling us to make these independent films, because it's funny to me how, on the one hand, the ability to make an independent film at costs far lower than they used to be for the same kind of quality, that's amazing and it's fantastic. But at the same time, on the other hand, the market for independent films has tanked. You know, you don't see, you know, there's very few theaters that play them for any length of time outside of New York and LA. It's hard to make money from independent films.
But what about what about the ability of, like, I mean, you can look at, obviously he's not independent anymore, but like the success of his name's going to escape me here for a second. Louis C.K., right?
Yeah.
He was basically independent through and through. And I guess technically he still is, because he said, you know, to hell with following the rules and guidelines of all these studios. I'm just going to take the money and I'm going to take my creativity and I'm going to put it on the line and I'm going to, you know, it start selling. Like, I think he started with producing his own comedy shows.
And streaming them on the web.
Yeah, and selling them for like $3 or $4 and getting enough people to watch it that it can actually pay for it.
There's definitely a way to make money. Mm-hmm. It's not that there isn't any way to make money. But here's the thing. It depends on building fan bases. You have to have a way for people to know that you're out there.
Yeah, and that's hard.
And we have now all these different means at our disposal to create art, to create films.
Yeah.
But our ability to let people know that it's there, I mean, we even have ways for them to get to it easily and buy it easily and cheaply, mm-hmm. but they don't know it's there. There's so much of it there.
There is. It is a saturation in the market, which is it's tricky.
And that's the tricky part.
I assume that in the film, it's got to be very similar. Like in the podcast realm, there's something like 250,000 podcasts out there, and trying to reach an audience and trying to do something different. I mean, you can download 10 podcasts and have nothing, learn nothing, hear nothing new. It's just people that have their own inside jokes, and it just floods the market. And to try to, I mean, I fight for every single listener that I get. And if you know, I think it's funny. I had a friend who he does his own podcast. He comes on here every now and then. His name's Mike Stojic, and his podcast is all about alcohol, and it's called Make It a Double. And he was out. it's great. It's fantastic. I had to give him a plug. Check it out. Make It a Double, or it's doublepodcast.com. But he was on a road trip, and he went out somewhere and found a fan of my show, which I thought was fantastic. So I just reached out and talked to him, because I mean, it's an honor to be able to, I don't know, put something out there that someone else appreciates. And you're right. I can see how it's probably a double-edged sword, especially in the independent creativity area. You have this market that is now suddenly available, but you've also increased your competition in the same sense. But you know, with that said, there's only so much of the garbage that commercialism wants to put out that anyone can take. I mean,
right, exactly.
Where can folks find, do you have a website besides the AXA Monitor, AXA MONITOR? Is there anything for your specific films, or check out on IMDb? What's the best way for people to look?
Oh, well, I'm on, if you go to axamonitor.com, there's, you can click on anywhere my name appears, and that has links to my websites and IMDb and all that sort of stuff. So start at axamonitor.com, click on about, click on Carlos Pedraza, and you'll see my short bio there and links to, my Facebook, IMDb, all that.
And it's Carlos Pedraza, Pedraza.
That is
Onesie. Yeah.
Onesie, right. Otherwise, it'd be Italian and be Pedraza.
Pedraza, yeah.
Which, you know, it doesn't sound bad, but unfortunately.
That's funny. Yeah, you're from Colombia, right? Colombia.
I'm Colombia, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, great talking with you, Carlos. And you take care.
Okay, you too. Thanks,
though. All right. Bye-bye.
Like us on facebook.com/WWI Podcast and at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitwhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.